Welcome tonight. You have come. I invite you to join me in Hebrews 12, in a particular part of that chapter you see here, verses 18 through 24. And as you're turning there, I welcome all who gather this evening in the name of the Lord. It's good to see visitors in our midst. It's good to see college survivors come boldly striding back, having conquered once more. There is a bit of an affinity between tonight's lesson and last week's, but don't panic. If you weren't here, this lesson stands alone. But there are some ways that the two may resonate. In fact, tonight may be an effort to be more practical. But again, the lesson stands alone, so it will work for those who weren't here at all. But I can't help raiding the reading from our elder, one of our elders, reading in Romans 8. You heard Paul there, conform to the image of his son. And don't you see, there is in some way that image is before us, that image is in front of us, and it is our work to be shaped and to shape ourselves in the form of that image. But we can't do it really unless we get that image in front of us and keep it in front of us. So I invite you to join me in thinking about a particular passage tonight and the way it begins here. Look with me in chapter 12, and I read in beginning in verse 18. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. So I know the title is You Have Come, and I make that comment, start, you have not come. Well, the text does that for us. The text begins with a strategy here, a strategy of piling on. It's not enough to say you've not come to Mount Sinai. He could have said that in passing, but that's not his intention. His intention is to pile on. He wants us to see this and this and this. He wants us to enlarge, expand, enrich our sense of this fearsome setting. One, finally, that people find themselves being repulsed, being turned, wanting to draw back from. You've not come to that. And so this fits into what we know about the larger purpose of the book of Hebrews, a contrast between the old covenant and the new. And here the old covenant is somehow less desirable, somehow foreboding and off-putting in light of something else. And so here we're given this piled up imagery of that foreboding, of that to be resisted. Right? Finally, remember, as we've been told before about the book of Hebrews, or the writer there saying, Moses could not get you into the promised land. Don't go back to Moses. He could not get you there. Stick with the one who did, the new Joshua, who can do what the old Joshua did, take us in. Now the question is, into what will he take us? And here, we're given the very next word. If you look in verse 22, the very first word, but. You see, we're given this list, six items, fear and trembling, but. And then we come to our title, You Have Come. You have come. And then you see how the writer is balancing his work. He gives us a fairly extended list, and here an even more extended list of what you have come to. I know this is fairly familiar language. We've heard it in lessons not long ago. But I invite you to revisit it with me and think about it. We're not going to talk at length about each of these items, fret not. But we are going to rehearse. We're going to see that this, what the author is intending here, the Hebrew writer wants us to see an alternative array of images. And look what he says. And I'm reading here in verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. And there's the Hebrews connection explicitly. And to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. It's inarguable, the attempt here, the intention here. I want to use "and" a lot. I want to pile up once again images. But this time, the pictures, and in a sense, it's almost as if we're taking posters and plastering them around the room in front of us. We have this whole array, and you've come to them all. Do you understand the intention here is to compel us, I think. It's not to argue us, but to compel us into seeing what we're doing as something big, something important. We're not just killing time. We're not just proving our discipline so we'll pass up a football game for a while. No, we are doing something here, the likes of which reverberate through all of our lives. And that's, I think, part of what he's doing here is to create that picture, this picture of an astonishing array of association. Look what you've come to. Pick any one of those. I'm still waiting for us to change our sign outside and put on it the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. I don't know if that would get us any visitors or not. It may turn people away. It might make people curious. Just what in the world are those people doing in there? But it's a pretty astonishing label, it seems to me. And then, of course, that's just one of many. This is not the mountain covered in cloud, the mountain of the thundering voice of God. This is Mount Zion that you've come to. All right? Now, but my intention tonight is not to belabor the imagery. I think the whole point of imagery is to let it occupy your mind, let it furnish your mind, and then you go and do something with it. And that's our goal tonight. I want to think about what I can do because I've got this imagery. Not just this, and although Jesus, the mediator, is one of those, but in Romans 8, right? The image is there, the image of his son. And now we seek to conform ourselves to it. That's a Romans language 12. We take the form of, we transform our bodies, transform our minds so that we can take a form. And what prompts us to do that? Here's where I want to think about this possibility at least. The compelling reality drives practice. Now, as I said, I don't believe the writer argues the reality, at least in that array just seen. Now, you could argue that he does argue one covenant better than another through the course of the book of Hebrews. So we're again not resisting reason and logic and that kind of persuasion. But we also understand that the writer here knows that there are other ways that we are persuaded. And here, when you see a compelling reality, now obviously what I just showed you, that list of images, that list of assertions, is not going to compel everybody. Certainly not. There are people who say, long list, I got bored at item two. Surely. But I'm not talking about those people right now. I'm talking about us. And most of us, many of us, have said, we believe this to be the compelling reality. And if that's so, it's going to drive the practice that we have. 40 years ago and a half, I entered into marriage with that woman. I found myself a husband. I am a husband. That was a compelling reality. And I was clueless as we drove across the South from Florida to Houston in her 1970 Dodge Dart without air conditioning. We were confronted with a compelling reality. And somewhere along the way, she assured me I could not sing. I had to confront another compelling reality. And I want you to know, it drives practice. I have sung softly for 40 years and 6 months because of a compelling reality. But also, I want you to know this. To the best of my ability, I have tried to be a husband. I have husbanded. I've turned it into a verb. And we know that. If I have claimed Jesus 41 years and 6 months ago, entered into a covenant relationship with him. And from that moment, I have tried to be a disciple. I have tried to accept his discipline. And I've tried to conform my practice to that compelling reality. The examples of this are absolutely endless. In every part of our lives, we find this truth. I know I can look over here at people who are, well, all across the room probably, former high school band members. Come on now. Football team people, they like to pride themselves on that camaraderie and the discipline of the football team. And that may well be true, but I think it's those band people who do that. August, on a parking lot in Texas, at noon, standing there at attention, holding an instrument while somebody yells at you. That's a compelling reality. And people are driven. We live up to that. I'll give you another. There is a certain fast food franchise that seems to have especially pleasant people working for them. Now, do they just select really pleasant people? Or do they make them pleasant? My guess is it's some of both. But you know, somebody buys in and says, I'm part of this. And so I'm going to say, you're very welcome. I'm going to say that a lot. And I'm going to say it with a heartiness. I'm going to say it with a kind of an urgency and an endearing energy. And I'm part of something. And here, if I can believe that I'm a part of a kingdom, it's going to drive my practice. And so this is a ongoing fussiness, perhaps, on my part, but there are those who really think we need to be practical. And my first response to that is balderdash. We need ideas. But it's my contention that ideas are practical for this very reason. It is ideas that push you. For example, the idea that this is a person I love drives me to practices that promote the flourishing of that person. See? Because it starts with the idea. It starts with a vision. This is, and let me give you another example. And most of, well, not most, but many people in here know this. Even some of us emotionally challenged males, when you hold a little baby for the first time and it's yours, that's a compelling reality. And it drives practice. Some people, now, of course, again, like everything I'm saying tonight, it doesn't have to. There are people who turn and run away. But we're not talking about those tonight. We're talking about people who buy in and say, indeed, I am a father. I am a mother, and I've got to get after it. And so, as a teaching friend of mine said years ago, back in the days of cloth diapers, he said at first when he was rinsing those in the toilet, I'll say, at first he was rather timid, but it didn't take him long, and he was in there sloshing around with it because the compelling reality drove the practice. Ideas are practical, but they must be practiced. You understand? Some of you know this. I think this is an example that will catch people both ways. There are people in this room who, when they were in school, said, I am a student. And they lived it. They worked it. They were disciplined and diligent and all of those good things. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to confess this evening, but there are some in here for whom that was not true. And you knew it. It was not a compelling reality. Something else was. But whatever it was, something drove you to the practices. And it may have been your practice was to torment your teacher. Because that is the reality of my life. I hate this place, and I hate you, and I'm going to make you miserable. But others were diligent, and you know who you are. I want to go to the end of the same chapter now. We're still in chapter 12. And here we find ourselves in verse 28, where a practical pair of statements are given. Here, look at this. Therefore, see? Therefore, based on what's gone before, therefore, let us be grateful. Why? Well, look, for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Do you understand? Walk out of this room tonight. Walk out of this building tonight. I am a subject of a king whose kingdom cannot be shaken. Powerful language. I invite you to think about it. But, see, this one doesn't just give us that. It says, because that is true, you have the invitation to be grateful. Now, we heard a sermon recently. Jeff talked to us recently about being thankful. Very similar concerns here, but notice, see, this is a way of being that grows out of a recognition of a compelling reality. There is a kingdom, I'm part of it, it's not going anywhere, and because of that, let me be grateful. It doesn't stop there, it goes on. And thus, let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. I've spoken to you a number of times about this need, and Jeff's lesson this morning in some ways addressed that, this need to let God be God and fear, let us fear him as he is. But notice what it says, let us offer worship with reverence and awe, acceptable worship. Notice this, we have these two things. We'll come back to the opening stem in both of them, the let us, which is there. We'll come back to the produce department here in a minute. But what we're given here is a way of being and a way of doing. On the one hand, we get to be grateful. On the other hand, we get to offer worship. We get to do something. And that covers it all. We get to be and we get to do. Both of those matter because of what we know, because of that list that we've seen. And here's what I want you to see tonight. This is where we get trying to get ever more practical as we proceed through this. Notice when I'm grateful, I'm actually turning outward to the object that generates my gratitude. Similarly, when I offer worship, see, offer, just the very word offer suggests a handing toward, a directing toward. Right? And so in my being and in my doing, I am invited outward. That's the goal. And notice, I mean, it's kind of it's something of a paradox. One of the figures noted for you before. It's kind of a paradox because on the one hand, we have this large, grand array of images put before us of a king, a kingdom, and God himself and Jesus and the sprinkled blood, all that list. And then we turn from that, with that in our minds, we turn to practical things, we turn to daily things, we turn to small things. And so in a sense, we become the link, the transfer from the grandly abstract, from the very large to the very particular. And that's tricky. But when that happens well, in effect, we disappear. We disappear, and it is God and his kingdom, and it is the people that we'll talk about in a minute, we turn to help people. That's what matters. And that takes me back to Matthew 5, as noted in earlier times. Let people see your good works and glorify God in heaven. See? What's missing? You. You understand that? Let them see your works, the works that you did, but they don't say, my, what an impressive young person. They say, isn't God amazing? So you've disappeared. And that's the goal here. To be grateful and to offer this right worship, point me outward. We can get outside of ourselves, which is, I hope you understand, the great challenge. It is for me. We can get outside of ourselves, escape the tyranny of the self, and get on about the business of the kingdom and the assembly and God and Jesus. We can be modest. Now, I know when we think of the word modest, it comes in certain ways we think about either modest attire or modest about our successes. But I think I'm taking this even more practically, maybe more extensively. When I'm modest, I get out of my own way. I get out of my own way. And here it is. This is what I hope we can do practically. We can escape seeing and thinking comparatively. That's the word, comparatively, that I want you to wrestle with tonight. If the image of his son, or if the image of the kingdom and the assembly draws us onward, draws us upward, drives our practice, then we can escape ourselves and we can quit comparing, right? See, I've learned not to talk about people's hair. Whatever I say sounds like envy. So I just keep quiet. I don't compare. This afternoon I was at a tire store and this old guy, probably not as old as I am, but old guy, his car is pulled around, he gets in it. It was some kind of fancy Corvette, and he sits out there with this elaborate mechanical ritual of lowering his roof. And it was a lovely machine, just elegant, watch it happen. He's just sitting there, all these things moving. And it's opening up. I hope the top of his head got sunburned. No. Here was with all this elaborate, and then they brought my car around. I can't even get the seatbelt spring to retract, and I'm just kind of hanging out the door. All right, I was comparing, but you understand, the goal is actually two step one. Is okay, we compare, and then we really say and believe it doesn't matter. But that's only a step in the right direction. The further step, I don't even compare anymore. See, I don't have to, it's not about me comparing myself to you, it's about what can I do? What can I do to bring the image of the kingdom of God through my life into your life and me disappear. Interesting puzzle. I hope you'll think about it with me. But this is the invitation. We can escape seeing and thinking comparatively. We don't have to think somebody's smarter or not smart. Well, at least I'm not like, well, let's think about a Bible example of this. Pharisee, you remember this famous reference. God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, even like this. See, first he's talking about abstract groups that are not present, those people. But then he can't resist. There's someone else nearby praying, this tax collector. Do you see? And Jesus makes clear his judgment. This guy has it wrong. Now, maybe there are several parts to his wrongness, but at least part of it is he cannot resist thinking comparatively. You see? When Romans 12 tells us not to think more highly of yourself than you ought, well, we need to think just right highly. Because it's actually dishonest to not say you're smart if you are smart. Yes, I am smart. Yes, you have to say that if it's true. You have to know it if it's true. But you don't have to do this. I'm smarter than you. See, to say you're smart is one thing. That's just a recognition of the gifts that God has given you. Now, how can you use those for God? But the moment you turn comparative and say, I'm smarter than you, I have better hair than you, then it turns bad, it seems to me. And how do I get around this? I get around it because I let the vision, the compelling reality pictured for me shape my thinking. We've got some military men in here. You can tell people have been in the military. Mm-hmm. And I mean that as a compliment. There's a discipline. People, the way people stand, the way they sit. And the same is true for, again, apart from the military. You can tell a lady. You know. Because, see, that's the image. Or a gentleman. That's the image. That's what you have in your head, and every part of your practice filters that reality through your daily practice. I know that maybe I'm sounding way too abstract, but let me turn to this, because I know it's true and you know it's true. If I quit thinking comparatively, getting me in the picture, what can I do? Then I can pay attention. I can listen. I can appreciate, and I can help. I realize I didn't pay attention enough to you. See, I can pay attention to you. I can listen to you. I can appreciate you. I can help you if I'm out of the way. I don't have to think compared. Whew, I'm glad I don't have this problem. So the goal... The challenge, it seems to me, that's available to us if we have this compelling vision is I'm going to walk out of this room and I'm going to look at people and say, how can I pay attention to this person right here in front of me? And I'm going to enlarge this person's day by the way I talk to them. They will know that I've noticed them. Going to call them by name. They'll know because I've listened to them. I've actually heard them. I've recognized that this is a person with dignity. This is a person loved by God, and I want to know you as personally and as helpfully as I possibly can. That's an exhausting burden, but it's the invitation that we have, and I hope that you can see this as a challenge an invitation, but one tied to this compelling reality presented in the language of imagery. Instead of you, I've changed it to we. And you'll notice I've created a sandwich. We have come, and we can be grateful, relieved, delighted, and worshipful. Now, the text gave us grateful and worshipful, I believe. I've slipped the other two in. Maybe you can argue I've taken too much of a liberty, and I'll accept the challenge if you think so. But I do believe that if we can take the grateful and the worshipful as they are intended, then we can be relieved. We can be relieved of the overwhelming burden of keeping ourselves in the middle of things. We can step back and let the work of God come through us and offer to others hope. And then I think we can just be delighted. I'm not trying to fix you, make you like I want you to be. I want to delight in the way you are before God. We have come, and we can be grateful, relieved, delighted, and worshipful. As I said, we go back to the produce department at the end. 11 times that I know of in the book of Hebrews, in clusters, in three different chapters, two chapters with four, one with three, the writer smartly invites people. He says, look, I'm not telling you what to do. I'm not trying to get you to do what I've already done and let you join me where I have arrived. He says, let us. I'm in this with you. Let us do this together. Let us see. And when we see well, we can then change the smallest practices of our day to conform to that image that we see. Our posture will be different, military men. Our seating will be different, ladies. Let us do this. Let us see. And let's encourage one another to see grandly the vision of a kingdom that cannot be shaken, so that then I can get on about the liberated business of paying attention to you individually and all the people that you meet. Pay attention to listen and see and hear and help and notice, all those words that pile up the verbs that we could use. It's a challenge. It's an invitation. And I believe the Hebrew writer offers that to us. Let us be grateful that we're part of a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Let us offer worship to God. And let us bring him delight. Many of us have done this already. Many of us have joined in a covenant. But I hope tonight that you've seen this opportunity as a chance to be reminded of the grandeur of the vision and to the practical implications that grow out of it. It may be that somebody here needs to embrace the grand vision for the first time. You need to understand that there is a kingdom, and it was initiated by the blood shed by Jesus the Christ. When he died on the cross and was buried, was raised again, and then eventually seated at the right hand of God in heaven, he became the king of the kingdom, and we can be part of that. And tonight, if you would like to join him by your profession of your acknowledgement, he is the Son of God, and then once you've done that, if you will enter the waters of baptism so that you can come out of those waters having been washed from your sins, and then you can then proceed on the day-to-day small and grand work of conforming yourself to the image of his Son. If you need to make public response, please do so as we stand and as we sing.